used to have that I don't have anymore. Instead, I need to discover what I have now, not only to celebrate, but also to recognize I'm not helpless. As I continued to ponder that idea, I realized I had more going for me than I thought. I had focused so heavily on my losses that I had forgotten what I had left, and I hadn't realized the opportunities I might never have had otherwise. In the article, the blind man said something like, "I'm not going to worry about what I can't do. I'm going to do what I can do well." Those words seemed simple. I read that article at just the right time, and the words seemed incredibly profound. God had sent the message I needed when I needed it. It was one of those powerful moments that caused me to say, "I've got to get on with my life. Whatever I have, I'm going to use it and magnify it to the max." I'm running out of time, I thought, but so is everyone else. I suppose I'm more conscious of time than some people are for two reasons. First, I lost a big chunk of my life because of the accident. Second, I know we don't get to stay long on this earth. As many of the old hymns say, we're really like strangers passing through. It's something we all know from reading the Bible and other books, but those realizations became a wake-up call for me. I also know that my loved ones are waiting for me at the gate. Some days, I can't wait to get back there. I also realize that I have to wait until God sends me back. Members of South Park Baptist Church moved our family while I was hospitalized. We had been living in a town called Friendswood, about 10 miles from the church. We had needed a place near the church, but hadn't found one. While I was in the hospital, the church leaders found a house, rented it, packed up everything for us, and moved us. When I got out of the hospital, I entered a house I had never seen before. After the ambulance backed up and unloaded me from a gurney to my home hospital bed, I stared at our house for the first time. I soon adjusted to the new living quarters because for a long time I could only see the living room where they set up my hospital bed. In some ways, the move into the rented house was more difficult on the family than on me. I sensed some of the adjustments and difficulties my wife went through with my illness. Eva almost lost her job because she had spent so much time with me that she ran out of conference days, vacation days, and sick days. Other teachers donated their own sick days to her so she could come and be with me in the hospital. Eventually, she ran out of those donated days and had to go back to work. She was our primary source of income. Eva's colleagues at Robert Louis Stevenson Primary School in Alvin often graded her papers for her, wrote her lesson plans, and covered her classes when she left early to come see me in the hospital. Her fellow teachers even made little gifts to give our kids each day so that they would have something to look forward to. They called them surprise boxes. Fellow teachers also came to our home, along with church members, to clean our house and bring meals. Had it not been for the teachers and the church, Eva would have certainly lost her job, and so would I. Yet even with these incredibly sacrificial gifts and assistance, how she and our children got through the spring semester of 1989 remains a miracle. One time when Eva inquired about my long-term prognosis, a nurse told her, "Honey, you don't need to know all of that. You're just a wife." To that nurse, she may have been just a wife, but Eva took over and functioned for both of us after my accident. I had always taken care of the bills, bank accounts, insurance, and most family matters. She had no choice but to handle them herself, and she did everything well. Eva found strength and a new level of confidence. God provided her with the wisdom to help her take care of family matters. She also learned to remain calm during my complaints and grumbling throughout my lengthy recovery. The church didn't stop paying me, But we realized that they might, and they were entitled to because I wasn't working. We never talked about the money, but it was always a possibility that hung over our heads. When the state of Texas was found at fault for the accident, the law limited their liability to $250,000. All the money went to hospital bills, and $250,000 didn't make much of a dent. Ironically, the Attorney General of Texas defended the man who drove the truck that hit me because the defendant was an indigent inmate. Therefore, my tax dollars went to defend the state and the man who caused the accident. Isn't life strange sometimes? During the 105 days I spent in the hospital, Eva had the most strain. Not only did she take on the burden of everything in our home, she got up at 6 every morning and did everything she had to do around the house and hurried to school. As soon as school was over, she rushed to my bedside, where she stayed until 10:30 every night. Day after day was the same stressful routine. One of the most challenging experiences for her, by herself, was to buy a van to replace my wrecked car. By then, I was home and was able to walk with my Elizaroff still attached. That meant, however, that if I wanted to go anywhere, we had to have a van to transport me. We had no idea how long it would be before I could sit in a normal sedan. Eva had never bought a vehicle in her life, but she didn't complain. She went to a dealer, test drove a van, picked one out, and brought it home. "Here's our van," she said. She made me proud of her, and I felt very grateful. I learned to drive again in that van. One day, as the family was washing it, I walked outside still wearing my Elizaroff. As I lumbered around the van, I noticed that the driver's side door was open. Peering inside, I calculated what it would take for me and my 30 pounds of stainless steel to get behind the wheel. While the family wasn't looking, I maneuvered myself into the seat and started the engine. My family was stunned. Eva came around the door and asked, "What are you doing?" I smiled and said, "I'm going for a drive." Incredulous, she stammered, "But you can't." However, something told me that not having driven for nearly a year and having had my last drive end in my death, it was now or never for taking the wheel and driving again. I backed out slowly and drove around the block. It wasn't a long drive, but it was another milestone in my recovery. I'm still not fond of 18-wheelers or long 2-lane bridges, but so far I manage to get where I'm going. Of course, it fell on Eva to make all my appointments and to see that I got to the doctor's office twice a week. And I must add that I wasn't the easiest person to look after. In fact, I was difficult. As my health improved, I became demanding and curt. I wasn't aware of that. And Eva agonized over trying to please me, although she handled it well. The fact is that I was very unhappy. Many of the problems stem from my feeling completely helpless. For a long time, I couldn't even get myself a glass of water. Even if I could have poured one for myself, I couldn't have drunk it without help. Even the simplest tasks made me feel useless. Eva often had to make decisions on the spot without talking to me. She did the best she could. At times when Eva related what she had done, I was quick to let her know how I would have done it. Almost immediately, I'd realized I hurt her feelings when I did that. But the words had been said. I reminded myself and her, "I'm sorry. You're doing the best you can." I also reminded myself that regardless of how I would have done things, I wasn't able to do them. Although she said little during that period, she later allowed me to read what she wrote in her diary. One entry reads, "Don is critical of everything I do. He must be getting better." That's both sad and funny to me. She knew I was getting better because I started to make decisions again. The desire to get active in doing things was her yardstick for my recovery. I seemed to want to get more involved in life and to question what was going on. I just wish I had been a better patient and made it easier for her. The worst part of my convalescence for the family was that we farmed out our three kids. They weren't orphans, but they lived with other people for about 6 months. Our twin sons stayed with Eva's parents in Louisiana. I know they weren't happy about having to move so far away. The distance made the boys feel detached and separated, but they handled it quite well. They were still in elementary school, and at that age, it probably wasn't too difficult relocating. Nicole, who was 5 years older and 13 at the time, moved in with her girlfriend's family and was able to stay in her middle school. It would have been much more traumatic for her to move away. The accident happened in January, and the kids didn't come home permanently until June. I felt terrible that we couldn't provide for our children. The kids came to see me on weekends during my hospital stay, which was tough on them. When they made their first visit to the hospital, a staff psychologist did a kind thing for them. He took all three kids into a room and showed them a life-size dummy with devices attached to it, similar to what was on my body. This way, he could explain what they would see when they entered my room. I'm glad he did that for them, because even many adults, not having that kind of preparation, showed obvious shock when they first saw me. In my condition, I interpreted their reactions as horror. When the children came into my room the first time, all three of them stepped as close as they could to hug me. They loved me and wanted to see for themselves that I was okay. Of course, I was barely alive, but it still did me a lot of good just to see them. The staff didn't let them stay long. As awful as I looked, the children believed me when I said I would get well. After they left, Eva came back into ICU. I don't remember this. I don't remember much from those days. She said I looked at her through my oxygen mask and said, "We have the best kids in the world." I've never gotten the impression that our children felt as if they had missed anything, but I sometimes felt that they were cheated out of experiences with their father. When I finally was out and could walk, I remember trying to play pitch with the boys, even though I couldn't take more than a step or two. If one of them hit the ball that went out of my immediate range, I couldn't chase it. They felt terrible about that. I sensed my limitation kept them from enjoying the game, so we stopped doing it. Although they didn't say so, I knew they didn't want to see me try to run or risk falling down, though many times I did fall. Also, both boys liked to surf, and before the accident, I went surfing with them. After I was able to walk and drive, on several occasions I loaded them up and their boards in the van and drove them to the Gulf. But I couldn't do anything with them. I could only watch. They seemed to understand, but it was still hard on me. I have no doubt that there are things my sons probably wanted to do, but they never mentioned them for fear of putting me in a situation where I'd have to decide whether I might hurt myself. So I do feel that the boys were cheated out of normal boy things in their growing up years. Nicole, being a girl, had that daddy thing. She was our oldest child. She expressed her feelings very differently from Joe, who is a very emotional kid. Chris is the cool one, although deeply sensitive, and doesn't show his feelings as easily as his twin. While writing this book, I asked my kids to tell me how the accident affected them and our family, and how it changed their perception of me. When the accident happened in 1989, Nicole was 13 years old. Here is her response. "The biggest impact on my life was living away from my parents for several months. I lived with the Malden family from our church during that time. The accident taught me to appreciate my own family. I am very close to all of them, because I realize how fortunate I was to be a part of such a wonderful family. I also feel that I am able to help people in crisis situations because I learned at a young age how to use prayer and friends to help me get through difficult times. It caused me to look at life in a different way. At a young age, I was able to realize that life is precious and that we have to seize every moment. I feel that our family is very close because of the accident. I also feel that we really look after one another and that we would do anything for our family members. The boys and I have a special bond that we don't always see between brothers and sisters. Daddy's accident and recovery taught us to be there for each other. Mom became a lot stronger and independent because Dad couldn't take care of the things he always had. I only wish Daddy didn't have to go through this to bring us closer together. After Dad was hurt so bad, I saw for the first time that he was a vulnerable person. Before the accident, he had seemed indestructible. Over the years, I have seen that the accident has made him even stronger. He may have been hurt physically, but he is the strongest person I know spiritually and emotionally. To have gone through what he did and still be a loving and devoted servant of God is amazing to me. For a long time, I was angry about the accident, but I grew up and realized how fortunate we are to still have him and how the accident brought us closer. If he had died in that accident, I don't know how I would have made it through some of the toughest times in my life. There's something very special about getting advice from someone who has been to heaven, survived countless surgeries, and lived to tell about it. I tend to listen a little harder to him now. Joe was 8 years old at the time of the accident, and this is how he responded. My first memory was being picked up by a teacher friend of my mother's. When I saw my mom crying, I knew something was very wrong. I remember going to the hospital to see Dad. They showed us a doll made up to look like Dad's injuries, so when we went in, we would be prepared. It was really hard to see Dad like that. We didn't stay long, which was fine with me because I did not like seeing him that way. Chris and I had to move in with our grandparents in Louisiana. I thought it was cool at first, but then I started to miss my family. I'm really glad I had my twin brother with me. Every weekend we drove from Bossier City to Houston. That got old very fast. The worst thing about the accident was that while other kids were going camping and fishing with their dads, I never got to experience those things. I still think about that a lot, even today. Sometimes I feel kind of angry and cheated or depressed, but in the past few years, I've gotten to go camping and fishing with Dad. I'm not sure that he realizes how happy that makes me. Through this experience, I realize how many people loved and cared about our family. If we hadn't had God in our lives, I don't know how we would have gotten through this. This is Chris's response. When you're an 8-year-old, your father is a superhero. He's invincible. When I first heard about Dad's accident, I didn't think it was nearly as serious as it turned out to be. Mom was upset when she told me the news, and she couldn't hide the tears. But Dad was strong, and I've never seen him cry. Even when I saw him surrounded by monitors in the ICU, hooked up to the oxygen and barely able to speak, I fully expected him to be home in a week. I wasn't present for most of the major surgeries. I went to live with my grandparents only days after the accident and saw my dad only on weekends. During those brief encounters, I began to understand just how bad he hurt, both his body and his spirit. I was fascinated by the metal contraptions that surrounded his left arm and leg, but I knew they caused him immense pain. He looked so worn out as if he had just woken up or maybe could never quite fall asleep. Sometimes I got the impression he didn't want me or anyone else in the room. Even as little as I understood about depression, I knew he was suffering from it. The first thing I did each time I visited him was to approach slowly and put my arms around him. I hugged him gently. For the first time in my life, he seemed fragile. Even when he returned home from the hospital, I continued the same routine. Come home from school and hug Dad. It was as much to reassure me as it was to comfort him. I hope it served both purposes. As my brother Joe and I grew older, and Dad's recovery continued, we became more interested in sports and outdoors. Dad would do his best to join us. I remember feeling terrible when I threw the football too far for Dad's reach. He'd stumble and sometimes he'd fall. I choked back tears on a number of occasions. I'm sure he did the same. But from an emotional standpoint, Dad was always there for me. He is vitally interested in what his kids do. After all, I suppose we make his return from paradise worthwhile in some regard. The family grew closer as a result of Dad's accident. We all took different roles out of sheer necessity. Mom became the decision-maker and disciplinarian during Dad's recovery. I tried to my best to be the man of the house. Sometimes I was really just a bully, but I grew out of it. I learned to lean on others as they leaned on me. Nicole mothered Joe and me as best she could. Dad suffered from depression 4 years after the accident, still does to some extent. Maybe he struggled with it before the accident, but if he did, I never noticed. Dad is fiercely independent and seldom lets his family into his darkest corners. I guess I'm the same way. Here is Eva's response to how her perception of me has changed. I was most surprised by Don's lack of determination during the initial days following the wreck. He had always been a fighter, one who was constantly pushing himself and others to do more. When he wouldn't try to breathe, it was almost as if I didn't know him. The depression had also been a new aspect. I learned to recognize the sign of a bad time approaching. It is harder when the pain is worse. He doesn't sleep, and the stress builds. Through the years, I've learned that if I leave Don alone, he eventually returns to a more even keel. When I wanted to tell him something he really needed to hear but didn't want to know, I had to bite my tongue. And on a few occasions, I didn't succeed. Today, I don't think of him as injured, even though I know he is and always will be. Don goes at such a pace that it is easy for me to forget his pain and handicaps. My husband is truly a remarkable person. My kids were probably more confident about my recovery than I was. They never saw me receiving therapy, agonizing, or throwing up because I had gotten so sick, or see me when I've tried to stand up too fast. As much as possible, we tried to insulate them. Eva saw me at my worst, but she protected the children as much as possible. Although they don't admit it, there probably is a dad gap for my children, especially the twins. Because they were 8 years old, they missed my being there for an important developmental time to help them learn to do things such as play team sports and go camping. Looking back, I think the accident affected my parents more permanently than anybody. In fact, they were devastated. I'm the oldest of three sons, and all of us had been healthy. Then, suddenly, when I reached the age of 38, they were heartbroken and felt helpless to do anything for me. For a long time, they thought I would probably die. My dad had been a career military man, and my mother had to learn to handle just about everything. Yet when they came to see me during the first week in the hospital, Mom fainted. Dad grabbed her and helped her out of the room. She wasn't prepared to see me in such bad shape. I'm not sure anyone would have been. Even now, I'm not sure my mother has fully recovered from my accident. But here are two of many very beautiful memories of my parents' devotion to me. First, during the summer following the accident, as if Eva didn't have enough to concern herself with, she decided to take the South Park youth to summer camp. That would have been my job had I been physically able. But she tackled it with gusto. That meant someone would have to stay with me while she was away. My mother cheerfully agreed to do so. The week of the church youth camp came, and Eva left me with Mom. Each day, Mother prepared meals for me, and I was glad to have her there. But I did dread one daily occurrence. My mother would be required to empty my urinals and bedpans. Now, I know she had diapered me when I was a baby, but a lot of time had passed between infant powderings and the present. I remember the first time I had to go when she was caring for me, and I asked for the bedpan. She acted as if it were the most natural thing ever. After I had finished, I agonized over having to tell her. She saved me the embarrassment by asking me if I was through. I just nodded. She took the bedpan into the bathroom, and then I heard one of the most remarkable sounds I have ever heard in my life. As she entered the bathroom and flushed the commode, I could hear my mother singing. In spite of the most lowly of tasks one human can perform for another, she sang as she washed out the bedpan. It was as if her whole motherhood was wrapped up in that moment. She was again doing something for her son that he could not do for himself. And she was happy and fulfilled. I will cherish that memory, for it defines the devotion that only a mother can have. Second, I remember one private moment I had with my father, equally poignant and dramatic. One day, following yet another 250-mile trip to see me for an afternoon at St. Luke's, my parents were preparing for the return trip to their home near Bossier City. For some reason I don't recall, Mom stepped out of the room. Alone now, my father came close to my bed and took my only unbroken limb, my right hand, in his gnarled hand. He leaned close to me and with great emotion and absolute honesty said, "I would give anything to trade places with you and take this on me. He's my dad. And more than at any other time, I realized how much he loves me." Repeatedly, my doctor has told me, "Everything we did for you is the best we can. Don't count on being able to live a long, productive life. Because of arthritis and a lot of other complications that will set in, you're going to have an uphill battle to be even as mobile as you are now." He knew what he was talking about. It's been 15 years since my accident. I've already felt the beginnings of arthritis. Weather changes affect me. I grow tired faster. Some of it may be age, but I think it's a reflection of the fact that I have to use my legs and knees in ways God didn't design them to be used. Even today, my left knee hyperextends, so if someone comes from behind and inadvertently slaps me on the back, I have to catch myself, or I'll keep going forward. I can't lock my knee into place to keep from losing my balance and pitching forward. I've tried to make light of this, quipping, "I've fallen in some of the best places in Texas," or I've considered commissioning some little plaques that say, "Don Piper fell here." One time, I led an outdoor conference in the Texas Hill Country. The ground was uneven, and I'd walk along, and all of a sudden, I'd fall. I wasn't hurt, but I fell three times the first day. Despite everything they did for me, one of my legs is an inch and a half shorter than the other. That alone makes my backbone curve. The backbone is beginning to show wear and tear, as are my hip joints. My left elbow is so messed up I can't straighten it out. Doctors did everything they could, including operating on it several times. The elbow was fractured on the inside, and when it knitted back together, It wouldn't allow me to straighten it. To use the doctor's expression, it's a very gimpy joint. An injury like that, he pointed out, is not forgiving. Once it gets messed up, it's hard to fix again. That is part of my new normal. Once, after a visit to Dr. Tom Grider's office, he asked me back into his private suite. Despite his busy caseload, I felt he was genuinely interested in me, and we talked about a lot of things. On a whim, I asked, "Tom, just how bad was I when they brought me in that night of the accident?" He didn't flinch. "I've seen worse." He paused for a moment, leaned over his desk, and then continued, "But none of them lived." I've had to find different ways to do things. I'm alive, however, and I intend to serve Jesus Christ as long as I remain alive. But I already know what's ahead waiting for me. I'm ready to leave this earth any time. Chapter 15, Touching Lives. 2 Corinthians 1:3-4. All praise to the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. He is the source of every mercy and the God who comforts us. He comforts us in all our troubles so that we can comfort others. When others are troubled, we will be able to give them the same comfort God has given us. 2 Corinthians 1:3-4. Sometimes I still ask God why I wasn't allowed to stay in heaven. I have no answer to that question. I have learned, however, that God brings people into my life who need me or need to hear my message, giving me the opportunity to touch their lives. One of the first times I was able to minister to someone as a result of my accident was when I was a guest preacher in a large church. They invited me specifically to talk about my trip to heaven. A woman who sat near the front and to my left began to weep shortly after I began to speak. I could see the tears sliding down her cheeks. As soon as we closed the meeting, she rushed up to me and clasped my hand. "My mother died last week. I'm so sorry for your loss." "No, no, you don't understand. God sent you here tonight. I needed this kind of reassurance. Not that I didn't believe, I did, but my heart has been so heavy because of the loss. I feel so much better. She is in a better place. Oh, Reverend Piper, I needed to hear that tonight." Before I could say anything more, she hugged me and added, "God also sent me here tonight because I needed this reassurance. Not that I didn't believe and didn't know, because I am a believer and so is she, but I needed to hear those words tonight. I needed to know about heaven from someone who had been there." So far as I recall, she was the first to talk to me that way, but certainly not the last. I've heard this kind of response hundreds of times. It still amazes me that I can be a blessing to so many just by sharing my experience. For those who already believe, my testimony has been reassuring. For skeptics, it's opened them up to think more seriously about God. 2 years after the accident, when I still wore leg braces and walked with crutches, I took a group of young people to a conference at Houston's First Baptist Church. Dawson McAllister, a great teacher to youth, was the speaker. He's so popular, he fills up the place. As happens when you work with teens, we were late in leaving South Park Church. I didn't say anything, but I felt extremely irritated with the delay. I wanted to arrive early because I knew the best seats would be taken if we didn't get there at least an hour before starting time. I tried not to let it show, but I was still upset by the time we reached First Baptist Church in Houston. Once we went inside the huge building, we realized, as I had expected, that all the seats on the lower floor were filled. We would have to climb the stairs. I groaned at the thought of having to do more walking, even though I was mobile wearing those braces, and the pressure of those crutches under my armpits tired me out. To make it worse, the elevator wasn't working. If that person hadn't been late, I kept thinking, I wouldn't have to hobble up all those stairs. It just wasn't climbing up the stairs, but the auditorium was so full that the only places left to sit were in the top rows. Our young people naturally raced ahead to claim those seats. They promised to save one for me on the end. I counted 150 steps as I painfully made my way up. By the time I finally reached the top, exhaustion had overcome me. I could hardly walk the last flight and across the back of the auditorium to the seat the kids had saved for me. Before I sat down, which also demanded a lot of effort, I rested by leaning against the wall. As I tried to catch my breath, I asked myself, "What am I doing here?" I could have gotten other adults to take the kids, but I really wanted to be with them. I wanted to feel useful again. I also knew this would be an exciting event for the youth, and I wanted to be a part of it. Boisterous laughter and shouting back and forth filled the place. The youth were ready to be blessed and challenged, but at that moment I didn't think about the kids or how much they would get out of the meeting. I thought only of being worn out. At that moment, self-pity took over. As I continued to lean against the wall, my gaze swept the auditorium. Two sections over, I spotted a teenage boy in a wheelchair. He was sitting with his head in his hands, his back to me. As I stared at him, I knew I had to go over and talk to him. Suddenly, I didn't question my actions, and I forgot about being tired. I leaned my crutches against the wall and then slowly, painfully made my way across to his section and down the steps. He was a large, good-looking kid, maybe 16 years old. When I got closer, I realized why I needed to talk to him. He was wearing an Elizaroff frame, which I hadn't been able to see from where I had stood. My tiredness vanished, along with my anger and self-pity. It was as if I saw myself in that wheelchair and re-experienced all the pain of those days. He was looking away from me when I laid my hand on his shoulder. His head spun around and he glared at me. "That really hurts, doesn't it?" I asked. He looked at me as if to say, "What kind of a fool are you?" Instead he said, "Yeah, it hurts very much." "I know," I patted his shoulder. "Believe me, I know." His eyes widened. "You do?" "I do. I had one too." "It's horrible." "I know that. It's just horrible. I wore one on my left leg for 11 months. "Nobody ever understands," he said plaintively. "They can't. It's not something you can talk about and have anyone understand your pain." For the first time, I saw something in his eyes. Maybe it was hope, or maybe just a sense of peace because at long last he had found someone who knew what he was going through. We had connected, and I felt privileged to be standing next to him. "My name is Don," I said, "and you've just met somebody who understands the pain and the discouragement you're going through." He stared at me, and then his eyes moistened. "I don't know if I'm going to make it." "You're going to make it. Trust me, you're going to make it." "Maybe," he said. "What happened?" By then I realized it hadn't been a voluntary surgery. "I had a ski accident." I noticed that he was wearing a leather jacket. I asked, "You a football player?" "Yes, sir." Briefly, I told him about my accident, and he told me more about what had happened to him. "I'm going to tell you something," I said. "One day, you will walk again." His face registered skepticism. "You might not be able to play football again, but you'll walk." I handed him my business card. "My number is on the card, and you can call me any time, day or night, 24 hours a day." He took the card and stared at it. "I'm going to walk back up there to my kids." I pointed to where they sat. "I want you to watch me, and as you watch, I want you to know that one day you will walk too." I laughed. "And I bet you'll walk better than I do." He reached up, grabbed me, and hugged me. He held me tight for a long time. I could feel his constricted breathing as he fought back tears. Finally, he released me and mumbled his thanks. "You found somebody who understands," I said. "Please call me." That boy needed somebody who understood. I don't know that I had much to offer, but I had my experience, and I could talk to him about pain. Had I not gone through it myself, I'd just be telling him, "I hope you feel better. You're going to be okay." Well-meaning words that most people used. When I reached the top row, perspiration drenched my body from all the effort, but I didn't care. I turned around. He still stared at me. I smiled and waved, and he waved back. The dejection and despair had left his face. Over the next 6 months, I received 3 calls from him, 2 just to talk and 1 late at night when he was really discouraged. They were phone calls I will always cherish, 1 struggling pilgrim to another. One time, a Houston TV station scheduled me to appear on a live talk show. While I was waiting in their green room, the producer came in and began to explain how the show worked and some of the questions I could expect to be asked. "That's fine," I said. "Who else is a guest on the show?" "You're it." "Wait a minute. You're going to do an hour-long show and I'm the only guest?" "That's right." I wondered what I would talk about for an hour. It was fairly early in my recovery, and at the time I had no idea how interested people were in my story. By then, the doctor had removed the Elizaroff frame, and I was wearing braces and using crutches. I had brought pictures of me in the hospital, which they televised that day, and I brought the Elizaroff device itself. Once the TV interview started, I told my story, and then the host asked me questions. The hour passed quickly. While we were still live on the show, a woman called the TV station and insisted, "I need to talk to Reverend Piper immediately." They wouldn't interrupt the program, but as soon as the program ended, someone handed me a slip of paper with her telephone number. I called her. "You've got to talk to my brother," she said. "What's the matter with him?" "He was involved in a fight in a bar, and another man pulled out a shotgun and blew his leg off. He's wearing one of those things like you used to have on your leg." "Of course I'll talk to him," I said. "Where is he?" "He is home in bed. Give me the address and I'll go." "Oh, no, no, you can't go over there. He's angry and mean and he's violent. He won't talk to anybody who comes to see him." She gave me his telephone number. "Please call him. But he's so mean right now, I'll guarantee you that he'll cuss you out." Then she added, "And he may just hang up on you. But try him anyway, please." As soon as I got home, I called her brother and introduced myself. Before I had spoken more than 3 sentences, he did just what she had predicted. He yelled at me. He screamed and let me have it with just about every swear word I've ever heard, and he repeated them several times. When he paused, I said quietly, "I had one of those things on my leg that you have, the fixator." He didn't say anything for a few seconds, so I said, "I wore one of those Elizaroff devices on my left leg. I know what you must be going through." "Oh, man. This is killing me. It hurts all the time. It just... And he went off again as if he hadn't heard me, preparing his anger with a lot of profanity. When he paused, I said, "I understand what it feels like to have one of them. You don't have it anymore?" "No. I finally got it off." "If you do what you're supposed to do, you can get yours off one day." That didn't sound like much, but it was the only thing I could think to say. "If I had some wrenches, I'd take it off right now." "If you take it off, you might as well cut your leg off, because it's the only thing that's holding your leg on." "I know, but it's killing me. I can't sleep." And then he went on again, telling me how miserable he was and how much he hated everything. Then something occurred to me, and I interrupted him. "What does your leg look like? Does it seem to be hot near the pinholes? Is it the same color up and down your skin? Are there certain holes that hurt more than others? Yeah, that's right. One of them especially. Man, it hurts real bad. Is your sister there? When he said she was, I ordered him, put her on the phone. He didn't argue, and she picked up the phone. Thank you, she said. I appreciate so... Listen to me, I said, interrupting her. I want you to call an ambulance right now. Take your brother to the hospital as fast as you can get there. He has a serious infection in that leg. If you don't get there soon, he's going to lose the leg. You think so? I'm telling you. He has all the symptoms. He's probably got a fever, too. Have you checked? Yes, that's right. He's running a fever. Get him to the hospital immediately. Call me afterward. The next day, she called. Oh, you were right. He has an infection, and he was in terrible shape. They gave him all those antibiotics. They said he got there just in time, and he's doing better today. I assume he's still in the isolation unit? When she said he was, I added, I'm going to come and see him. As a minister, I could get in to see him. I went to the hospital, talked to him, prayed with him. Eventually, that young man turned to Jesus Christ. If I hadn't been on that TV show and his sister hadn't watched it, he might not have only lost his leg. There's a strong possibility that he would have died. Not only had God used me to save the young man's physical life, but I had been an instrument in his salvation. That was just one more instance of my beginning to see that God still has things for me to do here on earth. I had immediately recognized the problem because it had happened to me when I was still in the hospital. I had gotten an infection and began hurting badly. I thought it was just part of the pain I'd have to go through. Then a nurse discovered that I had an infection in one of those pinholes. I remembered then how days before one of the nurses apparently had cross-contaminated the pinholes. She was a surly type and never showed me much compassion like the others. She came in and did her work, but she acted as if she resented having to work with me. They used Q-tips, and they had been instructed to use a new one to clean each hole. I had noticed that this time the nurse didn't get a fresh Q-tip each time, probably because it was faster not to reach for a new one. I didn't think anything about that until after the hole became infected. My added pain had come about because of her laziness. Once they discovered the infection and my elevated temperature, they rushed me into the isolation unit where I stayed for 2 weeks. While I was there, no one could visit me. Eva complained and told the doctor what happened. I never saw that nurse again, so I don't know if they fired her or transferred her. As much as I enjoy public speaking, few opportunities excite me more than speaking at my alma mater, Louisiana State University, LSU. My wife and I met at LSU, and two of our three children also studied there. One of the on-campus organizations where I have spoken on several occasions is the Baptist Collegiate Ministry, BCM. While Nicole was a student at LSU and served as one of the officers in that group, the BCM invited me to speak. Knowing she would be in the audience made the experience even more delightful. Among the many campus activities the BCM sponsored was a Thursday night praise and worship service called TNT. The committee asked me to speak to them about my accident. The students advertised my talk all over the campus as Dead Man Talking. Because so many showed up, they scheduled two back-to-back services. As I spoke, the audience seemed mesmerized by the story of a man who died and came back to life. I spoke of heaven, answered prayers and miracles. I told them about singing What a Friend We Have in Jesus in the car with Dick Onorecker. As each service ended, the praise band led us in a chorus of that meaningful song. I didn't know they were going to do it. While I have no doubt they were led by the Spirit to do so, What a Friend We Have in Jesus remains a difficult song for me to hear or sing. Afterward, a large number of students waited around to ask questions. Among them was an African-American student named Walter Foster. He asked many questions himself and stayed and listened to the other students' questions as well. When I left the auditorium, Walter followed me. Although I didn't mind, I felt as if he pursued me with dogged determination, as if he couldn't get enough details about heaven or hear enough about my experience. A few months later, Nicole called me. "Do you remember Walter Foster?" Her voice broke, and she started to cry. As soon as I said I remembered him, she said, He died. He suffered a heart attack, just like that, and he was gone. Apparently, Walter had known about his serious heart condition and was under medical care. Everyone assumed he was doing all right. Obviously, his death shocked all the students who knew him. 21-year-old students aren't supposed to die, one of his friends had said. After I hung up the phone, I thought back to the day when Walter and I met. I wondered if he had had a premonition about his death. The fact that he had followed me the whole time I was at LSU and plied me with endless questions about heaven caused me to wonder. His questions seemed more than just curiosity. Maybe, I thought, even then God was preparing him for his homeward journey. His sudden death devastated his friends, especially those involved with the Baptist Collegiate Ministry. They were a close-knit group and mourned the loss of their dear member. The night following his death, they gathered at the BCM building, the place Walter loved most. During an emotional meeting that night, a number of his friends spoke at length about how much it had meant to Walter that I had shared my experience about heaven. Many mentioned the excitement he expressed to them over what he had heard. He talked about it for days afterwards. Several times during the day when Reverend Piper was here, one of them said, Walter told me, "One day I know I'm going to be in heaven myself." Pressing church business kept me from being at Walter's memorial service at First Baptist Church of Baton Rouge. Nicole represented our family and reported that evening about the celebration of Walter's life. Two special requests from his friends were that the preacher would share the gospel message and that someone would sing one particular song. Of course, it was "What a Friend We Have in Jesus." The audience learned the special significance that hymn held for Walter. Nicole, a music major at LSU and an excellent soloist, sang the song to the assembled mourners. They responded with both great sadness and glorious hope. Tears flowed, and many smiled peacefully. After the service, many students lingered to talk about how much Walter's unwavering belief in heaven had comforted and encouraged them. One of the other bright things to emerge from my testimony at the BCM and Walter's later passing was the construction and dedication of a prayer garden at the LSU BCM. That seems appropriate to me, because each time I share my story, I stress the paramount importance of prayer. After all, I am still alive because of answered prayer. Like many others whose lives have divinely intersected with mine since my accident and my return from heaven, Walter represents those who will be waiting for me the next time God calls me home. Sue Fail's first husband died of cancer. His long, torturous passing took a lot out of her. She assumed she would live the rest of her life as a widow. But her neighbor, Charles, also without a spouse, changed that. They were not only neighbors, but in their common sense of loss, they became good friends. As time passed, they seemed to fulfill needs for each other in a way that only those who have loved and lost seem to understand. Their friendship evolved into love, and they considered marriage. Sue had serious reservations about marrying Charles because he had come from what she called a rough and tough working-class neighborhood. He had a history of hard drinking, and she said, "I can't live with that." As their love continued to grow, however, Sue issued one simple condition for marriage. I won't marry a man who gets drunk. Charles not only stopped getting drunk, he quit drinking altogether. Now they were ready to talk of marriage. One day they talked about the death of their spouses, both of whom had died of cancer. If I'm ever diagnosed with cancer, he said, I'll kill myself. He knew that not only did the person with the disease suffer, but their loved ones went through deep agony as well. I couldn't put anyone through that ordeal. They did marry, had a good marriage, and Charles never drank again. Sue had already been active in our church, but after their marriage, Charles also became active. One day, however, he received the one diagnosis he feared most of all. He had cancer. Now he had to face his deep-seated terror. He was afraid that his diagnosis would put Sue through the same terrible ordeal she had faced before. He also faced another fear after he received the diagnosis. The news forced him to confront his own mortality. I'm terrified of dying, he confessed. Although Charles was a church member and said he believed, he was one of those individuals who doubted his salvation. Sue assured him that while she was dedicated to seeing him through the crisis, she was concerned about his lack of assurance of his salvation. She had heard my testimony about heaven on several occasions and had retold my story to others. Can you talk to Charles? She asked me one day. He needs to hear your testimony from you. By then, I had become the single adult minister of Pasadena's First Baptist Church, where I am today. Sue and I had worked together on projects on many occasions. Please talk to him about salvation, but also tell him about what life is like after death. I believe that a man-to-man talk with Charles would do a lot for him. I knew Charles, of course, and because of his past, I suspected he thought he wasn't good enough for God. I agreed to talk to him. Charles and I hit it off right away. He was a great guy and easy to relate to. I made it a point to visit him on a regular basis. Whenever I came, Sue excused herself and stayed out of the room until I was ready to leave. Even as Charles' health deteriorated, he never displayed the least bit of anger or depression. We even talked about how difficult it was to be dependent on others for even the most personal of functions, bedpans, urinals, and bathing. About the fourth time I visited, Charles finally opened up. I'm afraid. I want to go to heaven, but I need assurance. I want to be certain that when I die, I'll go to heaven. As he talked about his life, it was obvious that his experience with God was authentic. As is often the case, for many years before he married Sue, he simply hadn't been a faithful follower of Christ. Several times, I reminded him of the verses in the Bible that promise heaven as the ultimate destination for all believers. I know, he said. Before I was saved, I knew I wouldn't go to heaven. I was going to hell. Now, I want to be sure about heaven. My description of heaven encouraged him. Yes, yes, that's what I want, he said. On one visit, as we talked, he smiled and said, I'm ready. I'm at peace. I finally know that I'll go to heaven. On both of those last two visits I made, Charles said, tell me again. Tell me once more what heaven is like. I told him again, even though he had already heard everything I had to say. It was as if his assurance grew each time I talked about heaven. A short time before he died, Sue put Charles in a hospice at the Houston Medical Center, just a few doors away from where I had been hospitalized for such a long time. On the last day of his life on earth, Charles told Sue, "It's going to be all right. I'm going from pain to peace. Someday we'll be together again." When Sue called and told me, she added, "He died absolutely without fear." Charles's calm assurance and acceptance gave Sue peace as she worked through her own grief and loss. She told me that only weeks before his death, he'd said listening to my experience and seeing the positive glow in my life made the difference. "It's settled," he'd said. "I know I'm going to a better place." As Sue shared her memories of Charles, she laughed and said, "Won't I be the lucky one? I've got two men waiting for me. One day when my time comes, I'll have one on each arm, former husbands who are also brothers in Christ, and they can escort me down the streets of gold." When Joe, one of my twins, reached his teens, we decided to look for a used car for him. He wanted a truck, so we searched until we found one he liked, a 1993 Ford Ranger. The dealer's name was Gary Emmons. He owned a longtime automobile dealership in our area. Once we settled on the truck Joe wanted, we went inside to make the deal. Mr. Emmons gave us an excellent price, and Joe bought the truck. Because of that experience, a good relationship formed between Gary Emmons and my family.